the event, the four events in February. But of course, it's my great pleasure to welcome back Dave Rico. He has spoken in this store many times. The occasion of this talk is to discuss this topic, making love last. And it's clear that this is a topic of interest to many people, given the number of bodies here in the room. Dave is, as you can see from this set of books here, which is not exhaustive of all his work, but contains most of it, is quite prolific, an author, a very well-selling author, one of the best-selling authors for Shambhala Press. And I'm looking forward in particular to the way he always ends the talk with a fantastic poetic quote. Of course, now I've put him on the spot, and we'll see if he can live up to my foreshadowing here. But I know it will be entertaining, and I'm so grateful that he could come tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob. Well, first of all, I appreciate Rob and Stuart and Jim for inviting me. This is more than a bookstore. It's an environment. It feels like a holding environment for us to look at some of the issues that face us in life. So I like being part of that. This is three CDs, which are made from a one-day workshop that I gave at Spirit Rock in Marin. And the title I wanted was Letting Love Last, but they insisted on Making Love Last, which is contrary to Buddhist teaching, because everything's impermanent. But this is about how to sustain intimacy and nurture genuine connection. So that's the topic. And I'd like to begin by saying that many of us have a fear of real love. We don't have a fear of the excitement and the adrenaline that passes as love, which is really the romantic phase of love's journey. Because your adrenaline may be aroused during the conflict stage of the relationship in a very different way from the way it was during the romance phase. So the Hollywood version of love has something to do with the adrenaline, the excitement, the heady feeling that you have when you're really into someone. And it usually, of course, includes a sexual dimension, so that adds to the sense of pleasure and excitement. And there's, of course, nothing wrong with any of that. It's just that it doesn't quite tell the story of what love is about for humans who are on a journey and pass through various phases in whatever they do. So the phases of relationship, and these phases are based on a study done with California couples, inquiring into what kind of changes happened in their relationships, and they all agreed on three basic phases. The first one is romance. That's what I was just describing. The second one is conflict. And you start to rub each other the wrong way rather than just rub each other. And then the third phase is the true commitment. A commitment would be described then not as the marriage, because the marriage could take place during the romance phase. The commitment is the point at which the two people are faithful to each other in keeping agreements and in working through whatever obstacles come up in the course of the relationship. So instead of defining commitment as having a ring on your finger, this would be defining commitment as I stick with it when something comes up and I'm open to working it out with you. I don't run away. And when I make an agreement, I keep it. I act with integrity. And if I fall down in my commitment, I'm willing to admit it and make amends. So that would be the nature of a truly healthy commitment. When you look at this subject of love, you would have to begin in the first experience of love, which happens in our childhood. And if you stop to think of it, we came into the world with some very basic needs. I call these needs the five A's. We have a need for attention. So we have to have some way of communicating when we're infants the difference between wanting to be fed or changed or held. So somebody has to pay attention to us if we're going to survive. Secondly, we have a need to be accepted just as we are, rather than designed by our parents to fit the mental representation that they have of us. Instead of their trying to make us into something, they're intensely and enthusiastically curious about what we will turn out to be. Thirdly, they value us. They appreciate us. Fourth, they show affection in physical ways, because now we know that certain parts of our brain do not activate except with the physical holding. And this is true of all mammals, not just ourselves. And finally, when the time comes for us to be weaned and to move away from our parents and move out into the world, they can allow that to happen. Hence, five A's: attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. These five A's, which are our basic needs, turn out to be the very same needs that we go into an adult relationship to find. So in effect, you could say that real love happens in a situation in which you can consistently trust that the other person is paying attention to you, accepting you as you are, appreciating you and your feelings, showing physical affection in whatever way you've agreed upon, and allowing you to move on if that's what you need to do. So the love is letting go idea. So you see nature's evenness, that the same needs we came into the world with are the ones that we stay with all through life. And we're always looking for these five A's from other humans. We even need them. We were not meant to be totally alone. Just alone at times, but not all the time. Now, the interesting part of all this is that it's not as easy as it sounds. If the needs were fulfilled in a good enough way in childhood, with the receiving of the fulfillment of the need comes a wonderful capacity to trust that other beings in the world can love me too, and that a reasonable amount of these five A's is satisfactory. I can be satisfied with someone who pays some attention to me and accepts me in many ways, not all, and so forth. So with the providing of fulfillment from our parents who loved us in good enough ways, we became able to go out into the world and look for a reasonable amount of these five A's, rather than having the opposite, which would be a bottomless pit, so that you're always out there trying to get more and you're never satisfied. Everybody follow? The ability to be satisfied comes with the fulfillment. That's the beautiful economy of the human psyche. So if the needs were not fulfilled, at least in a good enough way — they don't have to be fulfilled perfectly — but if they were not fulfilled in a good enough way, then ever after, whichever one of the five, or all, was missing, will be like a hole in ourselves that can never be healed or filled until we acknowledge it, grieve what we lost or missed, and let go of blaming our parents, and accept the fact that we didn't have the perfect childhood, but the one thing that we still have is the capacity to love others, and that that is a wonderful grace to be thankful for. So that's what we would come into the relationship world with. We come in with the realization that even though life hasn't been perfect, I can still learn how to love more and more. How do I love more and more? I keep my commitments and I show these five A's. How do I know if somebody loves me? He or she keeps commitments, keeps agreements, works things out with me, and shows me these five A's. That's the basic topic of this. And I also talk about the two fears that come up in the course of a relationship. One fear is that the other person will leave, will abandon me, so it's a fear of abandonment, and that would make me cling so that the other person wouldn't go. Opposite of allowing. And the other fear is the fear that someone might get too close and smother me. That's the fear of engulfment. And it's a rare couple in which both people would not have at least one of these two fears. So one person has the fear of abandonment and is clinging, and the other person can't stand being clung to because he has the fear of engulfment. You can see how that would lead to a conflict. How would you work this conflict out? You would put it on the table, talk about it, try to understand where it comes from, acknowledge that it's not a real fear. You see, an adult can't be abandoned. Not as long as there's MapQuest. You could be abandoned as an infant. You could be left on the doorstep in a basket. But you can't be abandoned now. People can leave you, but it's not abandonment in the sense that I won't survive because nobody's here. And you can't be engulfed. You can only be crowded. So these fears we give dramatic names to, showing that they must hearken all the way back to childhood, when everything felt like a life and death experience, because our very survival was at stake if our parents didn't pay attention. Everybody follow? One of the characteristics of a fig tree is that it's at the beginning of the season, it puts out one perfectly formed fig. This fig is called the explorer fig. It, to use human terms, it looks around in the environment, checks out the water situation, the sun situation, and then it gives the message to the rest of the tree, you can all come out. Or, don't come out this season. So you don't want to pick the first one. You just, because the first one is checking out and giving you a message. Everybody follow? That's probably what happened to us in, when we were in the cradle, and we looked up and we saw those two people leaning over and looking at us, mother and father. And we said to ourselves, is it safe to come out fully with these two? Or do certain things have to be squelched in order for me to be okay here? Following me? So that would be the opposite of having the needs fulfilled. So we'd have to ask ourselves, who was it that gave the message, you can be fully who you are, you can open up in your entire fruitfulness, as opposed to, it's not safe to do so. So I'll just mention one last thing and then we'll open it up for questions. It's said that a relationship is based on trust, which usually means I can trust that the other person will not be unfaithful. And that's certainly very reasonable, and that's part of the commitment. But I'm proposing something a little different. Since one of the givens of life is that people are not loyal and loving all the time, wouldn't it make more sense to trust yourself to receive the trustworthiness when it happens with gratitude and appreciation, and to handle the infidelity, the betrayal, when that happens, with self-nurturance and without retaliation? Now, a complete change in the picture of what is trust. Because now it's, I trust myself to welcome in all the wonderful ways in which you show that you're trustworthy. And I know also how to handle if, when and if you're not so trustworthy. And since humans are sometimes trustworthy and sometimes not, this seems like a much more reasonable approach than I can only be with somebody that I can completely trust. I'm suspicious of that because it might mean don't let me have to feel anything painful. Protect me from all that. When you ask things like that, protect me so that I don't have to feel the bitterness and sharpness of what happens to humans, you're asking way too much of any one person. Because nobody can really take care of you in that way. It's like making the other into a higher power. Otherwise, the 23rd Psalm would say, my wife is my shepherd, I shall not want. But it isn't really like that. So that when you're looking for true, utter protection, you don't look to another person, you look to a power greater than yourself. In whatever way you want to see it. Okay. Questions about this part so far? Because I don't want to go too far afield. Yeah.
Yeah. Just sort of a question, comment, reaction.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that, okay, the five A's, it would seem to me that for a young person to receive all the five A's would be the exception rather than the rule. I mean, it seems like as I go through life, I see more dysfunction than I see function.
Yes, I'd agree with that. But, of course, I'm prejudiced being a therapist. So,
that's kind of a
and having question. The parents I had. So I can certainly agree. This shows that a big part of the work of becoming human is grieving and letting go of so much of the past. What does grief mean? Three feelings. I'm sad that it was like that. I'm angry at those who made it like that. And I'm afraid that other people will do it the same way to me. When you confront those three feelings in yourself, you're automatically a healthier person, and you have redirected the trust back into yourself. Oh, I can feel what this is like and live through it and still have the capacity to love others.
Yes.
That's where you let go of the retaliation.
You let go of what?
Let go of the retaliation. The retaliation gets in the way of your ability to love. But anyway, does everybody see how that kind of fits? Did I to answer what you were? Yeah, thank you.
You had mentioned that there's no abandonment, that one may leave.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned there's no engulfment, but I didn't get the other.
That you would just feel crowded by others. You wouldn't really be smothered when they hug you.
Exactly. Thank you.
It feels that way. It feels like, oh, I'm going to be smothered. I can't stand this. I'm going to lose my freedom. But that's not really the case. It's a dramatization of a fear that all of us have. Every single person has the fear that others will not like us and will excommunicate us, leave us out in the cold. And everybody has the fear that if I get surrounded by too many people, I'll lose myself. So it's understandable that we have fears like this. They were meant only to be a signal system so that we could have spatial needs fulfilled. Instead, they became bigger than life, usually because of how they came up in childhood, when we often felt abandoned by our parents, emotionally at least, when they didn't understand us. We felt like we were alone, we were just out there. And we might have felt, shall we say, suffocated when they were very controlling. So you can't say, oh, my mother was very controlling, and leave it at that. If she was very controlling, that may have disabled and confused some of the natural, psychologically healthy settings of the human psyche, one of which is I can get close to others without feeling that I'm losing my freedom. I can let others go without having to feel devastated by abandonment. Imagine if we had those two skills, how great it would be.
Great.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm pretty familiar with the story of the long spoons.
No.
Oh, that in both heaven and hell, everyone has these
long
spoons. And in hell, everybody tries feeding themselves and it doesn't work because the spoons are so long. And in heaven, everyone feeds each other and it works wonderfully well.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to call attention to the paradigm, the cultural paradigm, the cultural story that we bring our relationship into, and in which we try to make relationship work, and it's a significant part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the culture seems to encourage relations to be, I think, more ingrown than is healthy, and the role that community plays in holding the integrity of individual relationships and the role of relationship in community and that kind of a back and forth thing.
Well, thank you for bringing this up, and it reminds me of my one of the things I say in How to Be Adults in Relationships, which is, when you're an adult, you would never expect any one person to fulfill more than 25% of your needs, that you would have 75% fulfilled by yourself, your friends, your family, your community, your focus in life, your interests, your life purpose, your hobby, whatever it is, your spirituality, and nature. You'd be drawing from all those sources rather than, oh, I've got to get everything I need from this one person. It was never meant to be like that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been part of villages and clans and so forth. It was always meant to be something that was shared by many. What shared by many? The need fulfillment that needs to come our way. It was never meant to be provided by only one. Everybody follow? Other questions about this? Yes?
You were talking about really struck me saying that clinging was the opposite of allowing. Was there something similar with the engulfment thing? Is that...
Well, the person who feels engulfed runs, and the person who feels afraid that he or she might be left alone clings. So the running away is the refusal to pay attention. And the clinging is the refusal to allow. And I saw this wonderful explanation of these two fears in a book by Maggie Scarf. She was one of the people I went to for research. She's a psychiatrist professor at Yale. Anyway, this is her statement. And she's trying to show in this statement the gaming nature of the two fears. That they're not just fears, like the fear of a snake is not part of a game. That's an actual fear. Because a snake could bite you. That's real. But these fears are neurotic fears. They've become bigger than they actually are. So this is how she puts it, which I like very much. He runs, but never so fast as to get away. She chases, but never so fast as to catch him. See, that shows the gaming nature of it, that we're doing this for what reason? Just to maintain distance. Why would we want to maintain distance? Because we're actually afraid of the full loving embrace. We're not afraid of the sexual embrace, but we might be afraid of the real loving embrace. What is this real loving embrace? Somebody is actually paying attention to you, looking into you. That in itself might feel so threatening that you would avoid it. And you could go for years in a relationship and never know that you're actually afraid of being looked into by someone. That would be the equivalent of afraid to be loved. All alone or in twos, the ones who really love you walk up and down outside the wall. Some hand in hand, some gather together in bands. The bleeding hearts of the artists take their stand. And when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall. After all, it's not easy banging your heart against some mad bugger's wall. So, in those lines by Pink Floyd, you see the concept that I'm bringing up, which is, you know, here we are saying I want to be loved, but we actually create a wall around ourselves to make sure it doesn't happen. What is so scary about it? It calls forth a vulnerability. Now I am so close to you and love you so much, you'll be able to hurt me. And I want to avoid that at all costs. So two types of vulnerability. Vulnerare in Latin means wound. So vulnerability is that you have the capacity to be touched and wounded by someone else. It's a wonderful human quality. So that would be the healthy vulnerability. That's different from the vulnerability of a victim. Just keep hurting me over and over. I don't deserve any better. That is the vulnerability of codependency. We don't want that. But it's a great spiritual and psychological achievement to be vulnerable to someone else, to be open to being hurt by that other person. And it's, of course, going to happen in any relationship. We know that at some deep level, so we stay at arm's length. So that's what the other quote means. She chases, but never so fast as to catch him. That idea. Everybody see what I mean? Other questions about this? Yeah.
Your second phase, conflict. Is this something that, if accepted, and the couple knows how to transform this conflict into something that sort of feeds the relationship and creates a kind of deepness in their understanding?
Yeah, every time you work something out, that would be the equivalent of affirming and firming up the relationship. How do you work things out? I see it as a four-part process. The first thing is you have to address what's going on. You have to be able to talk about the elephant in the living room. Secondly, you have to process the experience by letting yourself feel what goes with it. So I allow myself to have the feelings that I have and I show them to you. And you show me your feelings too. So first we talk about what's going on. Secondly, we express feelings to each other without blaming the other, just as the pure feelings. So that's the equivalent of mindfulness. Third, we make some type of agreement to do things differently in the future so that things get better. And fourth, we keep that agreement. So we address the issue, process it, resolve it with an agreement, and stay faithful to our resolve. Or another way of saying it is integrated into our lifestyle. If you didn't see your parents do this, as models, then it would be hard to do it yourself.
Yeah.
I didn't see things worked out. I saw them arguing about the same thing over and over, you know, four or five different topics all through my childhood. But I never saw anything really worked out. Everybody fine? I mean, maybe you had that experience too. So then, and they certainly weren't teaching us this in school either. So you have to learn this. Anyway, as I am now fond of saying, we're a messed up generation, but at least we produce the self-help movement. So. And our kids will be healthier than we are. So at least we have that going for us. Other questions about this? So everybody's getting the basic idea. Yeah?
Can you speak towards the expression of anger, be it from fear or be it from establishing boundaries in the course of resolving conflict?
Okay. Actually, I talk about this on the CDs as a distinction between anger and abuse. So in true anger, which is a legitimate feeling, what is the definition of anger in the dictionary? I looked it up. It's a very good definition. Displeasure at injustice. You think somebody was unfair and you don't like it. That's anger. You may say to yourself, oh, I never get angry. But if there's anything that ever happens that you don't like, you're angry. It's just that we don't express it very easily, because we imagine that if we express it, people won't like us. But in reality, it's something that is perfectly normal. And it's up to us to work out a practice of how to express anger in a way that's not abusive toward others. Okay. So it looks like this. It looks like a list. So on one side you have what does true anger look like and what does abuse look like. Just gives some examples of it. With true anger, you're expressing a feeling in a clear, communicative way. When it becomes abuse, it's a tantrum. With true anger, you show it with a red face, excited gestures, and a raised voice. Perfectly normal way of showing anger. Red face, excited gestures, raised voice. With abuse, red face, menacing gestures, and a screaming voice. See the difference? One demands that the other person change. That's the abusive style. And the other asks for a change, but does not demand it. When it's true anger, you're informing the other about how you feel. When it's abuse, you're silencing, intimidating, putting down, bullying, and dumping on the other. And so forth. So could it be that some of us in our whole childhood never saw real anger anyway? If what you saw was more like this, then you didn't have a model for anger. That was abuse. And the only way to handle abuse is to leave the premises. Whereas with anger, you pay attention, I acknowledge it, let's discuss it, I'd like to make amends. or I like to discuss it. I don't see it that way, but help me understand where you're coming from. Anger is the shortest of all the feelings, very brief. So I describe it as like a flare. But abuse is held on to as lingering resentment, hate, grudge, a smoldering fire. See the difference? One smolders, goes on, the other one is just over with. The person with the real anger sees the other as a catalyst. The person with abuse sees the other as a cause. One treats the other as a peer, the other treats the other person as a target. So if you really wanted to express anger in a healthy way, you would make up your own list, or use this, and then try to follow it. Okay, I'm angry, and I want to do it in a nonviolent way. I don't want to go crazy. It will have no blame in it. And it will feel satisfactory no matter how the other person responds. What's the definition of hate? Rage with an unending need for revenge. No matter how much I get back at you, I always have to hurt you more. I will never be satisfied. That's hate. So hate would never be in the repertory of a truly healthy person. Why not? Because a healthy person is addressing, processing, and resolving. Resolving means letting go. A healthy person is not holding on to the smoldering resentment and can never get enough satisfaction of revenge. Healthy people aren't like that. So you have to ask yourself, did people come at me in childhood mostly with abuse or with the true healthy anger? You'll know the difference. If you're scared, it's probably abusive. If you're drawn to it and pay attention, it's probably the real feeling. There's something about real feelings that garners our attention. I've noticed it even in movies. When the person is really showing anger in a clearer way on the screen, I'm closely paying attention. I notice that. When they're getting really crazy and abusive, I get a little scared. So you can even see it there. Other questions?
I wonder if you see those two basic fears as each one sort of like being the shadow side of the other. So somebody that's afraid of abandonment is probably equally afraid of engulfment, but it's just like the unconscious part.
Yes. Probably we all have both feelings. We all have both fears. And we probably all would like to be abusive in some way, or are abusive. But now that we're going into this higher consciousness with all these crystals and pyramids surrounding us, we have no choice.
Is it possible that the definition of anger, you said it was displeasure with injustice, is that
right? Yeah.
Could that definition maybe be extended to include displeasure with unreasonable behavior?
Because to you that's unjust, unfair. It's based on your version of injustice. It's not, someone can't convince you, well, you have nothing to be angry about because of X, Y, and Z. Your feelings are totally legitimate.
I just remember.
Hold on one second. Let me just get this other question. Yeah.
You mentioned, and I would agree, that one of the qualities of anger is a flare. It rises very quickly.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight as to why that is, and whether that's its sudden arising is a reliable indicator that you're experiencing anger as opposed to, say, an abusive state of mind?
Well, you make it abusive when you blame intimidate, bully, scream,
yeah.
etc.
Why
and
does it arise so quickly as opposed to some other emotions that seem to
it must have a survival purpose. I mean, maybe, you know, primitive people had to react quickly and get over it quickly. And by the way, I saw this program on TV about adrenaline, and the doctor said adrenaline was never meant to be secreted for more than 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, it starts harming your body and your immune system. So that explains why it's short, because that adrenaline comes up and it's got to quiet down within the 10 minutes so you can go back to your normal state. And here we're, you know, in our society, we're feeling adrenaline all day long.
So that could also, so someone who goes into like a real rant,
yeah.
their adrenaline is pretty high as they're ranting and screaming, and I mean they could go on for an hour.
Yes.
So that could be pretty damaging to themselves.
Oh, absolutely. See, one of the problems with adrenaline is it also has a quality of addictiveness.
Yeah.
You become addicted to it. Probably most of our addictions are somehow connected to adrenaline. Like with illegal drugs, there's, you know, you're afraid you might get caught and so forth. That's all part of the thrill of it.
And so what about people who grew up in a household where there was never any anger permitted? What do those people do?
Well, what you're saying is there was a repression
yeah.
of the real feelings.
Right.
Because there's no household in which there wasn't a reason to be angry at one time or another.
Right.
Even daily.
Right.
But when you're embarrassed about feelings or afraid of them, then you don't want to allow them to arise. And that creates an atmosphere of repression. So ever after, you'll even be afraid of the real anger. You won't just be afraid of the abuse, you'll be afraid of any slight arising of anger.
Right. Yeah.
See, we weren't taught these skills. Like, what's the skill of showing anger? What's the skill of receiving anger without getting scared by it? Simple skills like that we were never introduced to. This is what we're trying to learn now. Late in the game, but better late than never.
Wouldn't you have to be kind of aware in her case of passive aggressiveness?
The alternative to the, yes, good point. The alternative to showing anger in a direct way is that you might do it passively, hence the phrase passive aggressive. Aggressive means angry, but you do it in a passive way. For instance, keeping someone waiting would be a passive way of getting someone to feel the anger that you don't want to feel. That's how it works. So you're projecting the anger onto the other person who feels it for you. So you get the thrill of seeing them in pain and you don't have to feel it yourself. Speak up and say directly, I don't like being put in this position. So let's try to open up the topic of you being angry at me. It's okay with me if you tell me directly that you're angry at me.
But isn't that blaming to say I don't like being put in this position?
No.
Isn't that blaming?
No, not at all. I don't like being put in this position of having this anger. It's not blaming the other person, it's opening up the discussion. But you can't listen to me on all this stuff because being Italian, we have a different way of doing it. So some of what I'm saying is based on that, not on Freud. But anyway, it seems sort of right.
Well, I was going to say that that's a great idea, but and I wanted to add, the other person is likely to think that they're not angry. Therefore, you know, it's sort of a futile road to go there.
Yeah, you're right. So you would just have to notice it, and then if you want to still be friends, then you just notice it.
And
accept it. Oh, I guess that's the way it's going to be.
Just ask for guidance.
Yeah.
Just ask for guidance.
Yeah. We need all the guidance we can get.
Yeah.
Part of this is the other mystery about us, which is we seem more oriented toward putting up with pain rather than being done with it. Emily Dickinson has a beautiful poem about this. She noticed that, of course, she was in Massachusetts, and she noticed that when the first signs of winter come, some of the birds fly away, fly south, and others stick out the whole winter, like the little sparrows. So she says, the southern custom of the bird, that ere the frosts are due, accepts a better latitude. We are the birds that stay. The shiverers round farmers' doors, for whose reluctant crumb we stipulate, till pitying snows persuade our feathers home. So we're the little sparrows begging the stingy Yankee farmers to throw out a little crumb. We're willing to put up with that. Whereas the Orioles flew to Santa Barbara.
That's why you live in Santa Barbara?
Yeah. No, really. Or you can just eat the fruit right off the trees. So what is it about us? Why are we the birds that stay? And that's the question you brought up. Like, why am I with so many people who don't seem to want to work things out with me or who abuse me? It's certainly a mystery. I guess our fear of change is stronger than our will to find contentment. Maybe this is what makes us so interesting as people. Okay, well, we're going to wind up pretty soon. You have one more question?
One comment from before. I remembered a quote that I saw in front of a church once that's many years ago, and it just suddenly came to me, that love isn't two people looking at each other, it's two people looking in the same direction together.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember how that struck me, and how it points to the importance of the vision that we share, and that very often what we're seeing unfolding in a relationship is the power of that vision. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, a relationship is a test of the strength of vision, of shared vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the commitment that we make to each other would then open out into a commitment to the world at large. In fact, in that study that I mentioned, the woman who did the study, I went to her workshop, and she said that she noticed that the healthier the couples were, the more social consciousness they had. The more they loved each other and worked things out, the more were they interested in the rest of the world. But I'd like to end with this beautiful poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. This is her sonnet that she wrote to her husband. And you've all heard it before, but maybe now when you hear it, it's with a little more depth and consciousness. I think it says a lot. And it's another way of describing this loving bond that we've been talking about. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, and tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Thank you all.